I'll just chant and then speak together. Yatredam yatute vishvam vishvasmin avapatiya tattvam brahma param jyotir akasham eva vishritam. Yatra,
where?
Idam,
this.
Vyajate,
manifested.
Vishvam,
the universe.
Vishvasmin, in the cosmic manifestation. Avapati,
is manifested.
Yat, that. Tat,
that.
Tvam,
you.
Brahma,
the
impersonal
Brahman.
Param,
transcendental.
Jyoti,
effulgence.
Akasham,
sky.
Eva,
light.
Vishritam,
spread.
Translation. My dear Lord, the impersonal Brahman spreads everywhere, like the sunshine or the sky. And the impersonal Brahman, which spreads throughout the universe, and that impersonal Brahman, which spreads throughout the universe, and in which the entire universe is manifested, is you. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In Vedic literature, it is said that everything is Brahman and nothing else. The whole cosmic manifestation rests on the Brahman effulgence. The impersonalists, however, cannot understand how such a huge cosmic manifestation can rest on a person. Thus, this inconceivable power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not understood by the impersonalists. Therefore, they are puzzled and always denying that the absolute truth is a person. This wrong impression is cleared by Lord Shiva himself, who says that the impersonal Brahman, which is spread all over the universe, is nothing but the Supreme Lord himself. Here it is clearly said that the Lord is spread everywhere, just like the sunshine, by virtue of his Brahman feature. This example is very easy to understand. All the planetary systems are resting upon the sunshine, yet the sunshine and the source of sunshine are aloof from the planetary manifestations. Similarly, the sky or air is spread everywhere. Air is within a pot, but it also touches filthy places and sanctified places alike. In any case, the sky is uncontaminated. The sunshine also touches filthy places and sanctified places, and both are actually produced by the sun. But in any case, the sun is aloof from all filthy things. Similarly, the Lord exists everywhere. There are pious things and impious things. But in the Shastra, the pious things are described as the front of the Supreme Lord, whereas the impious things are described as the back of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 9.4, the Lord says, Maya tatam idam sarvam jagat avyaktamurjina matstani sarva bhutani na chaham tvestavashtita. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All things are in me, but I am not in them. This verse of Bhagavad Gita explains that the Lord is spread everywhere by virtue of his Brahman feature. Everything rests in him, yet he is not there. The conclusion is that without bhakti yoga, without rendering devotional service to the Lord, even an impersonalist cannot understand the Brahma Tattva, the Brahman feature. In the Vedanta Sutra, it is stated, Atato Brahma Jivyasa. This means that Brahman, Paramatma, or Parabrahman, should be understood. In Srimad Bhagavatam also, the Absolute Truth is described as the one without a second, but he is realized in three features, impersonal Brahman, localized Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate issue, and in this verse, Lord Shiva confirms that ultimately the Absolute Truth is a person. He clearly says, Tat Tvam Brahma Param Jyotir Akasham Eva Vist Rittam. Here is a common example. A successful businessman may have many factories and offices, and everything rests on his order. If someone says that the entire business rests on such and such a person, it does not mean that the person is bearing all the factories and offices on his head. Rather, it is understood that by his brain or his energetic expansion, the business is running without interruption. Similarly, it is the brain and energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that carry on the complete manifestation of the material and spiritual worlds. The philosophy of monism, explained here very clearly, adjusts itself to the fact that the supreme source of all energy is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. This is described very clearly. It is also stated how the impersonal feature of Krishna can be understood. Rasoham apsukamteya prapasmi shashisuryayo pranada sarvavedeshu sabdhake parvusham rishu. O son of Kunti, Arjuna, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and moon, the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras, and I am the sound in ether and the ability in man. Bhagavad Gita 7:8. In this way, Krishna can be understood as the mystic power in everything. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Mutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanami Namaste Saraswati Devi Kola Vanita Chani Vishrita Sunyam Prasthati Desikani Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangam Mangayate Girimya Kripa Tom Hangam Deshi Guru Dindam Paramahalam Vyanam So, in reading this verse, and I remembered one experience I had with Srila Prabhupada in Los Angeles, and I think perhaps I've told you before, but Prabhupada's transcendental activities are eternally relishable. I was in Los Angeles, and Prabhupada sat down on the Vyasasana. It was in 1970, and Prabhupada sat down on the Vyasasana and started to speak a little and then asked a question. He said, how many of you are chanting 16 rounds? And everybody kind of fidgeted a little bit, but no one really said anything or made any effort to say anything. And then Srila Prabhupada asked again, he said, how many of you are not chanting your 16 rounds? And again, there was a little bit of discomfort, but no answer. And then Prabhupada said, how many of you are fibbing? Not exactly telling the truth. And then a few hands went up here and there, and a little bit. And then there was one devotee who was in Prabhupada's Vyasasana, and it was here, and there was a door here, and there was a hallway, and somebody was sitting on a ladder, and he was painting, and he had his hand up. And so Prabhupada looked at him and he said, but Srila Prabhupada, I've been working very hard to make Krishna's temple beautiful. And sometimes I'm only sleeping 4 hours a day. And Srila Prabhupada said, then sleep 2 hours. He said, somehow you must chant your 16 rounds. And then he said, you do not have to go looking for Maya. Maya is on the other side, on the back side of Krishna. He said, the minute you forget Krishna, Maya is immediately there. So here in this purport, Prabhupada makes a similar statement that Maya is on the back side of Krishna. Really, that which allows us to differentiate between the Supreme Personality of Godhead and His energy, whether it be the Brahmajyoti or Paramatma, which are different manifestations of His spiritual energy, or Prakriti, the material energy, or the interaction between the living entity, the jiva soul, and the material energy, and how that manifests, our ability to perceive where Maya and Krishna are interacting, or how Maya and Krishna are interacting in our lives, is really a matter of vision, of our transcendental vision. There's a story that came to mind about, the story took place in the 1920s in America. There was a Great Depression. I don't know if you're so familiar here, but the stock market crashed, very similar to what was happening now. They were trying to avert a similar disaster, but it happened then, and it was quite devastating. The whole economic infrastructure fell apart, and many, many people were committing suicide, jumping out of windows, and so many things, because they became from 1 minute a millionaire, the next minute a pauper, and they didn't know quite how to deal with it. So everybody was really trying to get jobs. They were struggling to find some means of work. And so one company, how many of you are familiar with Morse code? Do you know this Morse code? Morse code is a system used quite frequently of transmitting information by a series of dots and dashes. So by some electronic connection, it would be held longer or released staccato, and then it would be dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, 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 which means SOS. So anyway, there were different messages that were sent that way by adjusting the length of the signal. And so they needed somebody to read Morse code for them, and they were looking to hire, and so they put out an advertisement, and many, many hundreds of people came. Each person got a number, and they were all sitting in the hall waiting to be called. In the front of the room, there were three booths, and people were interviewing people to take a job, to get a job. And so the tension in the room was very great. Over 300 people came with one job. You could imagine people were kind of nervous. And in the back of the room, there was some construction going on. Some people were hammering and building something. And so gradually, the numbers were being called. And they got up to about 120, and all of a sudden, some man got up, ran to the front of the room, walked into the booth, and 2 minutes later, someone came out and said, okay, you can all go home now, because we're hiring this man. And so the people in the room were very angry. They were ready to riot, practically, because they had been waiting, and it was only 120, and there were so many people to go. This guy had gotten up without even acknowledging his number, and just went up there, and now he got the job. So then one of the persons who was doing the interview came out and he said, let me explain to you what happened here. He said the people in the back of the room were hammering, but they were hammering a message. And the message was, when you hear this message, please come up to the front of the room and tell us what's being said. So this man, he was listening, and he heard the message, and so he immediately went up to the front of the room and said, I heard the message, and so he got the job. Whereas all the other people were sitting in the room, and they didn't hear anything except bang, 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 bang. So what's different there was the ability of this man. His senses were trained in such a way that he was able to perceive the message. Other people were hearing the same sound, but their perception was different. All they heard was noise. So we also are surrounded by things, right? Visual things. Sometimes we drink water. Everyone drinks water, right? Everyone drinks water. And everyone looks at the sun. Everyone hears sounds around them all the time. The sounds of cars, the sounds of so many things. Many people these days, they walk around with things in their ears, you know, listening to music, and everyone has gadgets that can look at pictures and so many things. But the fact of the matter is that their vision is different, it's clouded. When the devotee, as Prabhupada quotes in this purport, when a devotee drinks water, he thinks raso hum aso. Krishna is the taste of this water. He thinks Krishna is the sound of the ether. He sees differently. He looks at the beauty of nature, and he sees Krishna. He hears sounds, and he hears Krishna. And even when there's trouble and tribulation, still he sees Krishna. Like Kunti prayed, Maya Jan Kashtanamada, Padya Hoshidamadhyam, Vilachasayunda, Drisha, Yatoguna, Dirtiroguna. That there's a curtain of deluding energy, illusory energy, Maya. And it covers our ability to see, just like when we go to a play and we see actors on the stage. We may not recognize who they are. Someone is dressed as Krishna, someone is dressed as Nisheni Devi, comes out of the pillar and you think, gosh, who is that? Because they're dressed differently, we can't perceive them. But the person who organizes everything, he can see. And the person who knows who everybody is, they can also see. So it's really not a matter of what's seen, but a matter of how we see. I wanted to, yesterday I read a poem, and some people thought it was a nice poem. So I'm going to read another poem today. I'm going to contrast a little bit here the vision of somebody in material life with the vision of somebody in spiritual life. Because really that's all we have. The material world is going to change. It doesn't necessarily go away until we leave this material body and enter into the kingdom of God. But while we're living here, Prabhupada said that devotional service and the kingdom of God are non-different. So how is that? We're still, you know, subjected to heat, cold, and we're still subjected to old age and disease, and our teeth are going to do their thing, and our eyes are going to do their thing, and we're going to have to see it differently. Day by day, minute by minute, as we go through our lives, we have to see it differently. And that if we are able to see it differently, then our experience in the material world will be different. We'll have a spiritual experience in a material situation. So I want to read this as the example of the materialist vision. It says, old age is golden, I've heard it said, but sometimes I wonder as I go to bed. My ears in a drawer, my teeth in a cup, my eyes on the table until I get up. Ere sleep dims my eyes, I say to myself, is there anything else I should lay on the shelf? But I'm happy to say, as I close the light, at least with trifles, I still have some sight. When I was young, my shoes were bright red. I could kick my heels right over my head. But then I grew older, my sneakers turned blue. But still, I could play jog and play golf with them too. Now I'm old, and my slippers are black. I walk to the corner and puff my way back. The reason I know that my youth has been spent is my get up and go has got up and went. I get up each morning and dust off my wits, pick up the paper and read the obits. That's obituaries, dead notices. If my name is missing, I know I'm not dead. So I pull up the covers and go back to bed. So you have somebody in the material world, all the symptoms are there. Just like Jitarashtra, he told Vidura, hey guy, get it together. Can't you see? Your throat's choked up with cough. You can't see properly. You can't hear properly. Your senses are falling. And here you are, like a dog, living at the hands of people who you previously tried to murder in so many different ways. Don't you have any shame? Get out of here and go perfect your life. And that was the one instruction that Dhritarashtra actually heard and took to heart of all the good instructions that Vidura gave him. So I wanted to contrast this vision where death is knocking, old age is knocking, the hair is falling out, it's turning gray, the eyes are losing their ability to see, we're unable to walk, pains, we see. Vidura was talking about how he thought he saw some little grimace, some little face of pain on Prabhupada when Prabhupada was making dandavats in Detroit. But if you look around, you'll see very obvious grimaces on many devotees as they struggle to rise from obeisances or after. If you come up to the ashrams of the men and women up on the top of the floors of the tower, you'll see when we get up there, as we get to the last few stairs on the fourth staircase, we're trying to get in. We're getting the symptoms, the signs. Krishna is knocking, knocking, knocking at our door. Maya is there. We're going through the stages, birth, death, old age, old age, old age, disease. The signs are there. What do we see? How do we read them? Do we just hear the hammering and we don't really recognize that it's saying, excuse me, but you're about to be removed from this material body. What are you going to do about it? Do we hear that message or do we ignore it? And so this person here, when he notices that he's not dead yet, he just thinks, okay, well, that's fine. Now he goes back to sleep. He'll get up in a few hours and take breakfast and then go on another day, another day, another day, until finally he reads his name in the obituary column, or somebody does. And then life is finished. Are we like that? Are we waiting patiently or impatiently, trying to get in as much enjoyment, as much sense gratification as we possibly can before the final curtain and the Maya Ajivani Kachchino closes on act 4 of our lives, and that's it? Or do we have a different attitude? So I was contrasting that to another poem. It goes, Krishna tadiya padapam kajapam jarandam adaiva me vishatam me manasarajam sa prana prayana smaye kapavata pitae kanta vado dandida smaranam kutashke. This is my dear Lord. Just now I am quite healthy, and it is better to die immediately so that the swan of my mind can seek entrance into the stem of your lotus feet and be locked in their network. Otherwise, at the time of my final breath, when my throat is choked up with cough, how would it be possible to chant your name and remember you? So a very different attitude the devotee has. That he sees his life passing minute by minute and anticipates, somehow or other, I have to think of Krishna. And if necessary, let me leave this body immediately so that I can, with clear focus, not being distracted by disease, not being distracted by anxieties, I can remember you, I can glorify you, I can be with you. Let me die immediately if that's necessary. We have that nice benediction that was given to the devotee, or that Brahmin who was giving benedictions. He said to the devotee, you can either live or you can die. Right? He told the others, the brahmachari, better you die immediately, so much austerity undergoing, but at the end there'll be moksha, so better you die right now. And for the butcher, you shouldn't live or die, your life is miserable one way or the other. And for the prince, he said, you better live forever, because when you die, you're going to suffer for all the sinful activities you've done, and it's going to be very sick. But for the devotee, he said, no, you can live or die, it doesn't matter. Because living, you're completely absorbed in the service of the Supreme Lord, and dying, you'll also be completely absorbed in the service of the Supreme Lord. After this body is finished, you'll just go back to Krishna and chant, dance, and be happy. And while you're down here, you'll chant, dance, and be happy, and take prasadam. So this is the vision of the devotee, that whatever it takes, let me just remember you, and let me be completely absorbed in your service. So it's clearly said in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that it's not possible to see the Supreme Lord without the process of devotional service. Sevan Mukherjee Bhagavad. So we need to, especially with the tongue, we start with the tongue. Let us use the tongue to glorify the Supreme Lord. Let us use the eyes to see Krishna everywhere. And let us use our intelligence to serve Krishna with all our heart and soul all the time. Because without that endeavor, we don't have any hope of going back to the spiritual world. We're experiencing the spiritual world right here around us. It's not like we have to die in order to be Krishna conscious or to have fun in spiritual life or to enjoy our relationship with Krishna. Death is not necessary. We can do it right when we're here, when we're alive, and even in old age, even in decrepitude, material suffering, we can still relish the relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We saw that with Srila Prabhupada, that even in his final days, when his body was quite deteriorated, I happened to be in Vrindavan at that time, and Srila Prabhupada was always completely lucid and always completely absorbed in Krishna. Even, I think Vishakha Mataji was describing the other day how even just moments before Prabhupada's passing, he was translating the Bhagavatam into a dictaphone, and Jayadvaita Maharaj was reading some parts of the scripture, and Prabhupada was speaking in a voice that could hardly be heard. It was so quiet because of his illnesses. But nevertheless, his mind and his intelligence were completely immersed in the stem of the lotus feet of Krishna. He was completely absorbed in serving Krishna. So we can take examples. Srila Prabhupada taught us, he was acharya, or is acharya, throughout his life, and even in death, teaching us how to pass from this world. Many devotees, even amongst us, have shown really amazing examples of how to lead this world and how to live in it. How to live in it. We have to live in it. So we have to live in it by remembering Krishna at every moment and seeing him everywhere. Arjuna, in the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is called The Three Modes of Material Nature, the first verse, Krishna says, I'm going to give you this information which is more valuable than anything else I ever gave you. And by understanding it, you'll be able to be happy. And it's interesting that, you know, we always talk about how in the middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita we get the highest information, which is, of course, Bhakti Yoga. But in this 14th chapter, Krishna says, I'm going to give you information which is higher than anything I've given you before. And one might wonder, well, how did that happen? I mean, there's only transcendentally you can have perfect, more perfect, most perfect, and even more perfect than that. And so how do you look at that? Well, I often think about it as if you have something that's very wonderful. It's outside your room. Maybe it's $1 million. Maybe it's a big Sunday feast plate. You have to choose your ecstasy. But whatever it is, it's out there, and you're tied up here. You're totally bound, hand and foot, and you're gagged, and you can't achieve that. Whatever it is, even if you know it's there, even if someone tells you, I've left for you the secret to a great treasure, you can't get it because you're tied up. And so the person who's going to be most valuable to you, or the information that's going to be most valuable to you, is that person who comes and tells you how you can get unbound or unties you. So, because unless you're untied, there's no access. Even though you may know it's there, and you can't touch it. It's out of your reach. So the spiritual master and the devotees and the shastra, they come and they give us the information how to get untied, how to remove the bonds of the material energy which keep us tied, rooted, bound up to this false conception of material existence, that we think that this material existence is all in all, and we suffer accordingly and enjoy minutely and temporarily as well. So therefore, this Three Modes of Material Nature chapter, and even the beginning of the 15th chapter, spends some time telling us how to cut the bonds of the three modes of material nature. And so then, as Krishna is describing the different modes and how they bind us, Arjuna finally requests him to tell, how do you recognize somebody who's unbound? How do you know? And so in four verses, Krishna describes to Arjuna how to be able to recognize somebody who is not bound any longer by the three modes of material nature. So this description, we often read it and we think that it's like way over here somewhere and way beyond us, but it's actually a barometer. It's a benchmark kind of system where we can judge, we can ascertain our level of spiritual advancement. And every sincere and serious devotee needs to look regularly at him or herself, however he's embodied at the present moment, and ascertain what his weaknesses are, what his strengths are, and make some concerted effort to improve his devotional practice, to try to shore up his weakest points so that he can see Krishna everywhere and remember Krishna everywhere. We have to be careful. There's this word that pops up occasionally in Prabhupada's purports, and he uses the word automatically. And we get the idea that all we have to do is sit around in the association of devotees, occasionally hearing the holy name and chanting it, and then everything will happen automatically. But it's actually explained that automatically will happen if we endeavor. And if we endeavor, then the process will automatically take us into Krishna's vision and get for us Krishna's mercy. And then he'll remove the anarthas from our heart. So I just wanted to read these verses there combined, because it's very interesting to understand how the vision becomes clarified and how our ability to perceive Krishna everywhere becomes clarified as we advance in devotional service, as we practice Krishna consciousness under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, by taking up the process carefully under the direction of the guru and the advanced devotees, then we move forward automatically. Because if we're practicing the process, then automatically it pushes us forward. So it says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active, who is situated in the self and regards alike happiness and distress, who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with equal eye, who is equal towards the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and in blame, honor and dishonor, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activities, such a person is said to have transcended the modes of nature. This is not the only place that Krishna gives these same, very similar criteria, that the idea of seeing stones and pebbles and gold the same, and seeing friends, enemies, well-wishers, mediators the same. So this is very difficult for us. It's very difficult for the conditioned soul to be able to have a vision whereby the quality of something is judged by how it helps us make spiritual advancement. Inherently, the material energy is neutral. It has no positive or negative connotation. But we spin it by our own vision. And we make it positive or negative by the way we see it, the way we perceive it. So just like this dot, 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 dash, 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 was perceived in a very unnoticeable way. People didn't even, maybe they thought it was annoying. Why are they making so much noise here? But the fact is that it had a very important message, and that message was able to be perceived by someone who had the ability to hear. So in the same way, the material energy, or a similar way, the material energy can be used in Krishna's service, and Krishna uses it also to teach us lessons, to move us forward, to give us insights into our eternal nature and to our relationship with the Supreme Lord. And if we use that benchmark to be able to see everything, perceive everything through the eyes of Shastra and how it can be used in Krishna's service, then we can actually understand that the material energy is our friend. It waits with folded hands to serve us in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So for us, the job is to try to see Krishna everywhere. And Krishna gives us many ways to do that. Prabhupada also gives us many ways to do that. And to use the material energy in Krishna's service. And by doing that, the heart becomes clean and we become able to understand Krishna in our lives. Here, Lord Shiva is about to enter now into the fourth section of his prayers, the fourth and final section, which is similar to the Bhagavad Gita, because in the last section also, the Gyan section where Krishna describes how to see the material energy and the relationship of the material energy with the Supreme Lord. So in the same way, in these few verses, these ending verses of Lord Shiva's prayers, he's going to describe to us first how the impersonalists misperceive the Supreme Personality of Godhead by thinking he's Brahman, and then by Paramatma, and ultimately Bhagavan realization is there. So by the prayers of the pure devotees and the teachings of the pure devotees, we're able to see things as they are. So I'll stop there, and if there's any question, I can try to answer Mahendra.
I was wondering what it means. What in chapter one was higher than what they gave, and what should you explain? The other is the beginning of this section of verses where Krishna explains all the beginnings as he felt. One who doesn't hate the illumination, the detachment is one thing so much. What does that mean?
Well, the concept of hate and like, or the dualities of liking and hating, come from material consciousness. So we understand that insights come and insights go. Situations come and situations go. Situations are pleasant and situations are not pleasant. Our reaction to them and our interaction with them changes according to time, place, and circumstance. But the devotee doesn't hate. He doesn't hate it when it's good or illumined or clear, and he doesn't hate it when it's not clear. Just like the Bhumi and Dharma, when they were standing as the cow and the bull and they met Maharaj Parikit, they had been through a rather harrowing experience in their association with Kali. And when Parikit asked them, well, you know, what's going on? You look, you know, are you okay? Their response was, yeah, we're fine. And well, what happened to you? Well, you know, some people say it's this, some people say it's that, some people say this caused it, some people say that caused it. But the fact of the matter is that we're transcendental to it. So that the realization of the self-realized soul is that he's not affected. And hate and like are indications that he is affected. So he's neutral. When illumination comes, he's neutral. When he finds himself unclear, then he just prays to Krishna to understand. Lord Brahma, he found himself in a situation where he couldn't understand what was going on. He was an illusion. He was sitting on the top of a lotus petal, looking around into darkness, and he had no illumination. He couldn't understand what he was doing there. So he didn't get mad. He got prayerful. And first he tried on his own to figure it out, but he wasn't able to figure it out, so then he prayed. And when he heard a response to his prayer, he immediately took up that process. And then he was able to see things clearly. And again, these things come and go. But the devotee just continues. Detachment? Detachment?
Yeah, detachment. Yes. Specifically, I was thinking about detachment, which means unwanted desire. So some unwanted desire attachment comes up.
But it doesn't say unwanted. It just says attachment. That one accepts things that come, and one accepts things that don't come.
Let's say that the body sees it somehow. So it's an attachment, which is an obstacle to the progress in Krishna consciousness. So how to deal with it, that's the question, not be, you know, hating the desire of attachment or hating yourself.
Well, but I mean, ultimately, you need to see, I mean, the devotee needs to see that everything that's being arranged for him is Krishna's arrangement. It's a lesson to be learned. So if we find ourselves attached to something, it's drawing us away from Krishna, then the attachment has to be eliminated, but not hated, just eliminated. You know what I mean? We can't get emotional over what happens. We just have to deal with it. So in my understanding, which is, I'm sure, very limited, but the emotional aspect of hating it or liking it is not really productive. What's productive is that we see it for what it is and then try to understand Krishna's what we're supposed to do about it. Very often we ask Krishna, we pray to Krishna to change our circumstance because we perceive that the circumstance is causing us disturbance. And so when we offer prayer, we offer Krishna, you know, get this person out of my life, or, you know, give me some money, or let me get a good mark. You know, something we ask Krishna for to change the circumstance of our life. But factually, an advanced devotee, any circumstance can be an impetus for devotional service. Just like Queen Kunti, she saw misery as an impetus for devotional service. So she didn't hate the misery, and she actually did, in some ways, saw her attachment as counterproductive to her devotional life. She prayed that her attachment to her family would be cut. But she didn't hate the attachment itself. She just prayed that it would be removed if it was an obstacle in her devotional life. So I think it's the emotional reaction that we see the obstacle as the cause. But really, the obstacle isn't the cause. Our reaction to it is the cause.
So how you explain that, for example, when you are a child, when he thinks and he discusses a specific problem, I heard the talk, I don't know, he that example you mentioned. He three times speak like that. So you can see outwardly in that mood, this person they really hate, for example, this desire or something like that, which obviously is not just impression.
One other thing is that this part of Bhagavad Gita and Krishna's instruction here is to someone for liberation. To become free from the confines of the material energy. But a devotee is not in that limbo. A devotee has a positive movement towards his loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there is a bhav, there is an emotion in terms of one's relationship with Krishna. And anything that's seen as an impediment towards coming to that relationship and it becoming his total absorption is not looked upon favorably. Just like the gopis, they curse Lord Brahma for making them have eyelids that would blink so that they couldn't see Krishna during that split second. So the devotee is not, someone in the impersonal, that's why the impersonal conception or the level of moksha or liberation is not really viable for the devotee, because there is that bhav, there is that emotional draw towards the relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and things that get in the way of that are not appreciated. Anybody else? Stop there. Okay, thank you very much.